Support for the Projection Booth podcast comes from Stitcher Smart Radio. Now podcast listeners can access the latest episodes of the Projection Booth and thousands of other podcasts on the go without downloading or syncing. Stitcher instantly delivers episodes of your favorite shows to your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio can be found in the iPhone and Android app stores or on the web at stitcher.com/booth.
From the mind of David Lynch comes a modern-day masterpiece, so startling, so provocative, so mysterious, that it will open your eyes to a world you have never seen before.
She wore blue velvet, but in my heart there'll always be precious and warm a memory through the years. And I still can see blue velvet.
Hey, neighbor. Here I come. You got about 1 second to live, buddy.
And I still can see blue velvet through my teeth.
Blue velvet.
Welcome to the Projection Booth. I'm Mike White. Joining me is my co-host, Mr. Rob St. Mary.
And it's PBR me. ASAP.
We're joined this week also by special guest co-host, Mr. Vincenzo Natali.
Hello.
Glad to have you here. This week we are talking about the 1986 film from director David Lynch, Blue Velvet. It's the fourth feature film from Lynch, and Blue Velvet was just as divisive as the previous three films. It's the story of Jeffrey Beaumont, a young man who comes home from college after his father has a stroke. Jeffrey finds an ear in an abandoned lot, which puts him on the path to unravel a mystery involving obsession, voyeurism, and the dark underbelly of suburbia. So as our guest, Vincenzo, tell me about your history with the movie when you first saw it and what your impression was.
Well, I saw it when it came out. There are very few directors who I've connected with to the degree that I connected with David Lynch. And I think I was 17 when the film was released, so it hit me at exactly the right moment, I think, just mentally where I was. And so it was very impactful. I mean, it was and it remains one of my favorite films.
I think I saw it in high school on VHS, and it was one of those things where I had seen other Lynch films and sort of being like a completist. You know, you get into a director and you want to see everything, and this was one that obviously was pretty easy to get because it got a pretty broad release and was available on VHS. So that was where I originally saw it. And I have to say that the tone of it when I first saw it was a little bizarre, and still is bizarre, but I've gotten to a point where I'm willing to accept it and go along for the ride, and I really like it. And I like a lot of the things he does in here, especially since Get Ready to Take a Drink. I'm a big fan of Louis Buñuel. So there you go.
Yeah, when I first saw it, I think I saw it on VHS as well, possibly on cable. And I used to watch it, you know, late at night at home in my folks' basement. And it used to freak me the hell out. And then it was showing on campus at U of M, and I went to see it. And everyone was laughing. You know, there were certain parts where people were laughing, and they were laughing at the Frank parts. Frank Booth, played by Dennis Hopper, in a wonderful performance. And at first, I was really mad. I was like, why are you guys laughing? This guy's really super scary. And then as I watched it a little bit more, I was like, okay, yeah, I guess I can see where Frank is funny. But man, it was a really weird thing to kind of get my mind around this guy who I was scared to death of, suddenly kind of thinking of him as a little bit more comic than I had at one time.
And the tone of the film, I mean, to be honest, Blue Velvet is a place I think if you want to start watching David Lynch, it's a good place to get in that's kind of straightforward because it actually has sort of a linear narrative. It's probably his most straightforward film that he's done. For the most obviously straightforward films would be The Elephant Man and The Straight Story. But in terms of tone, I know what you mean. You know, there's this horror element, there's this comedy element, there's a lot of things that are kind of anachronistic. It kind of takes place here and there and everywhere. It could be the 50s, because we have this older stuff, but we also have the current day, which was in the mid-80s. And some of the dialogue is really cornball, and it's almost cornball on purpose. So there's all of these different things that are going on in there, and I think that that's what, in a way, kind of makes it hard for some people to deal with, because it's not working on one track, and it's not as straightforward as they might want, even though it's pretty straightforward for a David Lynch film.
What I love about him, and why I think he's such an original and a genius, is that you enter into his world. All of those things that you're talking about, all those sort of disparate elements that normally would never work together, are harmonious when you're in his reality, and it's utterly immersive and powerful, and I have to admit, I got it. I really, really connected with it. Just like I connected with Eraserhead the first time I saw it. It really affected me, and it was, I'm sure everyone has this experience where there's an artist or musician or someone who they encounter who they feel sees the world exactly as they do. And that was my response to seeing his movies, and so much so that it actually almost, in terms of making my own films, was like a burden, because I had to kind of exercise David Lynch just to be my own filmmaker. But that's the kind of spell that it cast on me.
I know you meant the other kind of exercise, but I just had a little vision of you and David Lynch exercising and it being his new project, kind of like his weather reports.
Probably not his best project. Might be the most entertaining.
It's funny that you talk about how you can connect with it. And in a way, this may help the discussion to some extent, because to me, Eraserhead, and I think he's talked about this, sort of represents him sort of, use exercising again, all of that stuff when he was in Pittsburgh, in art school and all that, and the factories and the steel town and all that. But Blue Velvet, in a way, might be him sort of working through his youth in a small town that he grew up in out west. So I think those two films kind of represent really sort of autobiographical things in a way.
I'm sure of it. Well, I think, I remember at the time, you know, he came off this tremendous failure, which was Dune, which for me actually was one of the most painful experiences I've ever had watching a movie. I was so horribly disappointed by that film, probably unfairly so, but I really, really hated that movie. And it was devastating to me because I had been looking forward to it so much. I think for everyone, Blue Velvet, especially for him, Blue Velvet was this amazing return to form and a return to that world, like his world, where he had really taken a detour after Eraserhead. He made Elephant Man, which was based on an existing script he may have ended up co-writing, but took place in Victorian England, and then Dune, which is this crazy science fiction film. So I think those were two worlds that were, in a way, pretty far away from him and his own experience. So I'm sure you're absolutely right. I'm sure that in some ways Blue Velvet's quite autobiographical. As I'm positive Eraserhead is.
Yeah, there are a lot of things that are very different for him, but at the same time, you can kind of go back and see some of the themes already. I mean, just the whole idea of like disease and medical problems. I mean, just how horrific Jeffrey's father looks in the hospital. And to see that and to see John Merrick and to see, you know, Baron Harkonnen, and just the way that Lynch kind of deals with real human medical issues. And what was his quote? Something about like some of John Merrick's lesions were kind of like slow motion atomic explosions. You know, it's like, okay, you can see that. And I think that's wonderful. This is where he's really in his element. I mean, we start off the movie with that whole idyllic blue sky and the flowers and all this kind of stuff. And Jeffrey's dad out there watering the lawn and everything's so fine. And you dive underneath the grass and you see that whole horrible world of all the insects and just this turmoil that's going on, just this kind of really beautiful metaphor for what is going to happen throughout the rest of the film as we kind of dive underneath and see all of these horrible things that are happening in this idyllic wonderland of Lumberton.
Which incidentally is a real place.
Yeah, I've actually been to Lumberton.
Have you?
I have been to Lumberton, and then I drove down to Cape Fear because they're both in North Carolina, and I was a huge Lynch fan, and we were on a road trip, my friend Sean and I said, oh my God, there's a real Lumberton, and we had to go through Lumberton, and then we went down to Cape Fear.
Lost, lost, lost.
All this stuff with Lumberton's kind of funny because they don't tell you what state, even though we now know that, of course, it was shot in North Carolina, is that it has this sort of like everywhere and anywhere kind of feel that I really like of how he builds it. One thing that makes me smile is the fact that the radio station is Wood, W-O-O-D. I worked at Wood Radio, which is actually in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's not.
Oh, wow.
It's not in Lumberton. So I found that kind of funny. But that opening, you know, there's actually sort of two openings, and they mirror each other. There's both at the front and then at the end of the film. And the thing that I really thought was interesting is the film opens with that curtain, you know, and there's this, you know, score piece, and reminds me of sort of like an overture to a grand Hollywood film. You know, we get this idea of maybe like big melodrama, like Douglas Sirk kind of thing. And then we get into that montage. And when I was thinking about the montage of all that suburban clean and all that stuff, it kind of reminded me that maybe he was trying to make a comment on something like Reagan's Morning in America ad, which had been a few years before. Or it almost looks like an insurance ad. Like you could take those images and put, you know, life insurance, you know, and stuff like that. And then one thing I find interesting is the mother's in the house and she's watching TV and there's like a crime film or something on TV. So in this place, it kind of seems that, you know, the entertainment, the crime is entertainment. It's not real in this town. We don't have real crime in this place. And then the staging of the scene, all the things that we see. And then, as you said, sort of going under the flowers, under the dirt, and that's where everything lies. And that's sort of where I find the idea of the ear. If you want to talk about the ear for a second, is that it's almost like it's such a great image, but in a way to me, it's almost like a symbol. It's like we're putting our ear to the ground, to the dirt, to the, you know, what's underneath. And to find an ear, I think, is really interesting.
Yes, that's a human ear, all right.
Well, and it's also that whole portal to another world kind of thing. And I love the ants crawling over it. And here, people can take a drink if I say this, I suppose, is that completely reminded me of Boonwell as well, as far as the hand with all the ants and everything and that big, you know, open wound in the hand. And it was great to see that kind of, you know, called back with this.
I think there's been a lot of debate over the years as to how sincere David Lynch is in the movie, because there's the metaphor of the robins and the robin's return and everything is goodness and light again. But then, of course, the robin looks completely mechanical and fake, and and it has this bug in its mouth. And I wonder, I don't know myself, I wonder how sincere he is about it. If I had to guess, I would actually say that he is sincere, that all of the stuff that seems like a life insurance commercial and that's kind of corny, he actually, to some extent, believes in. And I don't think it's entirely meant to be ironic.
Yeah, there's a pretty big theme about insects that's in the screenplay, at least one of the drafts that I read, and even in some of the cut scenes where you see that there are termites in Jeffrey's house, and his aunt, his crazy aunt, the woman who would later have her rye bread stolen by Jerry Seinfeld and have cream corn on her plate.
I requested no cream corn.
She is there at the house and is constantly seeing bugs and manages to kill one and leave it out for Jeffrey to be like, you know, there are termites in this house. And again, it's kind of this whole like, life isn't perfect. You really need to watch out. And it's funny that those two, his aunt and his mom, they are aware, even though they are watching these crime dramas, they do seem to be aware that not everything is perfect in Lumberton, because they have that line about, you're not going down towards Lincoln, are you? And I love that when we find out that Dorothy Valens' house is on Lincoln, that amazing musical sting that we get. It just always makes me laugh.
It's one of the most quotable films of all time.
Oh, yeah, completely. Not just Frank. I mean, so much of it. There are so many great lines. You know, while I'm talking about the script a little bit, one of the things I found funny was how many of the great David Lynch moments aren't in the screenplay. And I don't know if that's just because he leaves stuff out, maybe because he wants to sell the project. I mean, there are things in here, of course, like, you know, the whole idea of Frank, instead of doing amyl nitrate, he's doing helium, which at first seems like it would be completely laughable, but I bet it would be one of the scariest things ever if he was doing it. Again, scary, funny kind of thing.
You're like me. Charlotte. Oh, what are these?
Please, Brad, let's go.
Don't say please, fuckhead! Oh, baby wants to juice them. What's the matter? Give him back. What's the matter? Just a little red, that's all. Let me feel. Come here.
Hey, leave her alone!
Yeah, well, he leaves out some of the stuff like Double Ed, the guy that works at the hardware store, the two black guys, and one is blind and the other's not.
Hey, Ed, how many fingers?
Four!
I still don't know how you do that.
None of that stuff is in there, and the thing about doing the chicken walk isn't in there, and I love that. Luckily, the guy with the biggest tongue, he's in the screenplay. Not the guy himself, but the little story about it that goes absolutely nowhere.
The Eisner kid lived there, had the biggest tongue in the world.
What happened to him?
I don't know.
Yeah, I actually, you know, it's funny. I had almost the opposite reaction because when I read the script, I was amazed at how closely the film adhered to it, although you're absolutely right about all of those additional pieces. I think one of the reasons Blue Velvet is one of my favorite, perhaps my favorite David Lynch film, is that it's so beautifully constructed. It's just on every level, you know. First of all, as a story, it's just a very finely tuned piece of noir mystery thriller. And it's utterly complete, and it, unlike many of his other stories where films would have mysteries in them, the mystery is completely resolved. it's not left open. And then as a film itself, it's a wonderful piece of classical filmmaking. It's very Hitchcockian. It's very controlled. It's very classic. It's just a really beautifully shot, beautifully cut, beautifully blocked and composed movie. I was amazed that in the script, all of that was there. If you read the script, it's the movie plus a little bit more. The things that they ended up actually cutting out of the film, which, like, thanks to this new Blu-ray, you can actually see they shot. But it's all there. I was under the impression, for what I knew about the way he shot, is that, you know, he improvised quite a bit, that he's very much, they call him Lucky Lynch, because there's always these happy accidents that he finds, and that's part of his methodology as a director, is to sort of discover things as he goes along. But in this case, I mean, it's pretty much to the letter. And the things that feel very improvised or like they might have been thought up on the day are there in print. I was quite amazed.
Yeah, I'm very happy with this Blu-ray because I had picked up the DVD when that came out, which had a lot of these, if not all of these extra scenes, but they didn't have the audio for them. So it was kind of a, you know, this big tease. So you got to see the stuff, but you didn't get to hear what was going on. And I want to say that the quality wasn't that good with the transfer of those scenes and everything. But yeah, with this new Blu-ray, oh my God, it is so great. And it is wonderful to see, especially kind of the lead up. I'm glad that they cut it because I think it would have kind of adversely affected the pacing. But the whole lead up between Jeffrey's father having the stroke and him coming back to Lumberton, where you get to see him at school, and especially the scene of him down in the basement college dance, which is kind of nice because there's an echo of the high school dance later on in the film, but where he's down in the basement at this college dance and he's watching basically this date rape going on, that's where you first get the idea that Jeffrey is this voyeur, and you get that throughout the rest of the film, of course, especially when he's there watching Dorothy Valance. But that's a nice little thing that we miss, and that's pretty much the only thing that I miss from that, other than the scene at the Slow Club, where that's the club where Dorothy Valance sings, the scene of some of the other acts that play at the Slow Club, especially the dog who eats on stage, and that's all it is. And this weird, like, rabbit drawing on the curtain. It's like, what?
Well, you know what was amazing about that stuff was, didn't it feel like those could have been outtakes from Twin Peaks?
Oh, yeah.
Or Wild at Heart? Like, it was kind of the level of absurdity that he went to later on. You know, I got to say, seeing those scenes on the Blu-ray, there's certain movies that are so iconic for me, and I've seen them so many times, that to see something that was cut out of the film, but, like, presented in a really pristine way, the way they did it, is utterly surreal. Like, it belongs to another universe.
It's like you found another gospel or something.
That's right. Yeah, no, that's it, exactly. That's exactly what it's like. That's a perfect way of putting it. I had the same experience when long ago when the Shining DVD came out and there was Vivian Kubrick's documentary, and you just saw all the stuff that, you know, you can't even, it was inconceivable. Maybe I'd never, ever, ever see. It was like looking at everything from this other point of view.
That scene with the stand-up comedian with those horrible jokes and the big egg and chicken silhouettes that move back and forth as he's telling the jokes. Oh, yeah, that totally. I mean, that seems like that same club is where Freddie Jones comes in and starts talking about how dirty pigeons are in Wild at Heart. Yeah, it's really seems like, you know, right from the same world, or kind of the talent show at when Miss Twin Peaks gets crowned. Yeah.
Yeah, it's an interesting. So you realize that it was all there. You know, that it was fully formed even at that early stage.
I've always wondered if this is in the script. Is the beer stuff? Is the beer stuff in the script?
The beer stuff is definitely in the script. Yeah, there's even an extra line when they are having dinner. Jeffrey comes over to the Williams's house and has dinner with Sandy, her boyfriend Mike, and the two parents. We get the line earlier of Sandy talking about how her dad drinks Bud, and she says it again, or he says it in that scene, that he's a Bud man.
Man, I like Heineken. You like Heineken?
Well, I never really had Heineken before.
You never had Heineken before?
My dad drinks Bud.
King of beers.
Like, I remember the first time I saw it, I really didn't understand, like, what this whole thing was, the Heineken PBR deal. And, like, when I look at it now through the lens of experience, there's this whole thing in there, and I think it's just a really quick line that someone throws at Jeffrey at some point, pointing out that he goes to Ivy League school. And to me, Heineken, at least at that time, would have represented an import. It was something bigger than yourself. It's bigger than this town. It's somewhere else.
What kind of beer do you like?
Heineken.
Heineken? Fuck that shit! Pabst Blue Ribbon!
Pabst Blue Ribbon represents just blue collar. This is what we drink here. You know, this is the standard operating procedure of here. You know, we're not elegant. We're not trying to be pretentious. And that's what an import beer in the mid 80s would probably represent.
Oh, Frank's here.
Well, those tarted up women are far from sexy. And they're just, there's a whole like cadre of them, and they're hanging out with Ben. And to me, I'm like, he's obviously queer in some way. Like, it's never kind of explained, but in a way that kind of goes back to film noir, because if you think of the Maltese Falcon and Peter Lorre, you know, he's obviously gay or something. These are deviant people doing deviant things in the world. So this sort of this, like, old, like, Hays Code subtext of film noir that runs through the Ben character, which the Ben character, Dean Stockwell, I mean, that's probably one of the most heavily quoted things in here outside of Dennis Hopper's ability to make the F word sound musical. It's amazing.
I have to say, it's one of those movies, and there's probably, for me, a handful of them that exist, where if I start watching it, I have to keep watching. I cannot stop, because every scene has something amazing in it. Almost every moment has something amazing in it. And there's, I mean, clearly when that film was made, it was kind of magical. And it, you know, for those who might be listening to this who were born later than us, you have to realize at that moment in time, there was nothing like this. It truly, Blue Velvet has no predecessor. And it articulated something in the culture that I don't think any other film at that time had articulated yet, which is just that, and I don't know if this was a conscious thing on the part of David Lynch, but was that America had, in a sense, forgotten, had in the 1980s had made an attempt to forget all the bad things that had occurred in the previous 10 to 15 years, the Watergate, the Vietnam War, and it was kind of a whitewashing and a return to what was perceived as a happier time in the 1950s. And of course, Blue Velvet is entirely about unearthing all of that darkness that had been carefully hidden away in the Reagan era. And there are countless movies that followed Blue Velvet that followed a very similar theme, a very similar conceit, but it was the first one. What I think makes Blue Velvet stand out, or stand the test of time, is that for all of its weirdness, it really makes sense. It's actually a very, very finely constructed mystery story. And frankly, I have some issue with some of David Lynch's later films simply because they're mystery stories that lead nowhere. and intentionally so, I understand that. But I personally always found that a little frustrating, and even maybe I felt a little bit lazy. Whereas Blue Velvet is, I mean, it's, you know, it's a Hitchcockian mystery in the most classic sense. And that's, how many of those work outside of what Hitchcock did? There are very few. Many people have tried to do Hitchcock-esque movies. Very few have succeeded. And Blue Velvet is one of those films, except that it goes further. It takes it in an entirely new direction. So it's a, yeah, I think you're right. Like, all of that strangeness sits so well and works so well because it has this infrastructure that is actually a very, very finely tuned and constructed story.
The one thing that's interesting for me about Dorothy is, first off, you're talking about just these little odd stagings, these little odd things. And when you look at the club she plays in, the stage is very elegant. It looks like something from a supper club of days gone by, but in the reverse, where they're sitting in the audience watching, it looks like a dive bar behind them. It looks like some sort of hick bar. And it's like shot in two different, completely different places, it almost looks like. It looks like the two things don't even match in any way. And that, it's just kind of odd, you know, that you have like this high, you know, gloss of this old school way of entertainment, and then you turn the other way and it's all like wood panel and there's like a Pabst Blue Ribbon sign in the background and all, you know, just odd. And then when he gets into the apartment and there's this whole interaction between Jeffrey and Dorothy, it's really interesting because she treats him really rough and she victimizes him for a while. And then we learn that actually she's a victim. So there's sort of this like circle of victimhood kind of thing. And then at one point, it almost seems that Jeffrey becomes a stand-in for some of the things that Frank was doing with her. Like, the only way that she can sort of relate to people is if they're being rough with her, if they're doing, you know, if they're hitting her, if they're doing all these like horrible things to her, then she feels, I don't know, loved or appreciated or something. I don't know. There's some sort of psychopathology going on there that's not necessarily very good.
Yeah, looking at it through kind of a BDSM lens, I mean, the smile that she gets when Jeffrey hits her, it's like, oh, okay. You know, it's really kind of a nice smile that she has on her face after he finally hits her. And it's like, she is, yeah, maybe Don probably didn't treat her that way. And I know that, you know, Frank is a little bit overboard, but maybe Jeffrey is the mama bear's porridge or something. I'm not sure.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, I think one of the first times or second times that I saw it, I looked at it possibly through the lens that maybe this whole thing was a setup. That, you know, in the end, we do see the guy who's missing the ear, but it almost seems like this is some sort of elaborate DS relationship. Because she gets really upset, like, no, no, you can't call the cops. It's almost like, you know, she wanted this, or this is some sort of arrangement, you know, sort of like, you know, people are into like cuckold fetishists or something, you know, where it's like, okay, you can have sex with my wife, but I'm going to know about it and it's going to turn me on. So maybe there's like this whole like really elaborate backstory with how she got involved with Frank and all this stuff. And I don't know, it just, it opens up these ideas of what really happened a month before all this happened.
I like that we don't see Donnie. We see him, or we hear her behind the door, and we don't even really hear Donnie behind that door. Just her, you know, no, no, mama loves you, that whole thing. And yeah, that whole weird mommy, daddy, baby thing.
It's daddy, you shithead. Where's my bourbon?
There are a lot of things that seem like they would, I don't think, you know, necessarily Penthouse Forum, but definitely some other magazines that might have read similar stories.
It feels authentic. I mean, for all of the weirdness in the movie, those scenes in particular feel like they come from some place that's true. And I think that's part of the power of it. I remember after the movie came out, we have a magazine in Toronto, which is where I'm from. It's like a cultural magazine that comes out every week called Now Weekly. And they always had very colorful personal ads. And there was a couple, or I don't know, maybe more than a couple, who just would, in the newspaper, quote Blue Velvet to each other. I think that the what was so shocking about it at the time was the fact that Dorothy is a victim, but to some degree a willing victim. And I think that I'm sure that it inspired a whole generation of fetishists. and it's because I think I'm sure that that kind of psychopathology is absolutely authentic. Whether, you know, David Lynch ever experienced anything like that in his life or not, I'm sure it's true. So there's something very deep about the movie. That's why it it stuck around for so long. Obviously the voyeuristic themes, the character of Jeffrey being this, on one hand, very straight, very upright, maybe even uptight guy, on the other hand, having this some sort of perverted side to him that he is maybe not fully cognizant of.
I don't know if you're a detective or a pervert.
No, it's for me to know and you to find out.
All of those things, I think, go very, very deep. And that's why people were so connected with the film so strongly and in some cases hated it so vehemently, because it was touching some nerve. It was telling a truth.
And I think that's probably the best place to take the break, because when we come back, we're going to talk a lot about that critical reaction. And also, I would say possibly, and I think you touched on it a little bit there too, Vincenzo, is the influence of Blue Velvet. So we're going to take a break and play an interview with author Paul M. Salmon.
The Flash Pulp Podcast. 3 to 10 minutes of fiction brought to you thrice weekly. Now it's 3 apocalypses in one.
Yeah!
Suffering from tough, stuck-on humans? Well, 20 hellish hours of suffocation in the all-encompassing web of Karwick the Spider God will get them right out. Too many brains lying around? The ravenous mouths surrounding zombie-fighting Ruby will quickly clean those up. Nosy neighbors? Infect them with the murder plague, and watch as they dissolve into paranoid maniacs bent on the preemptive assassination of their friends and family. Why stop at one end of the world when you can have all three? You can find them all at flashpulp.com or search for them on iTunes.
This is Adam Spiegelman from the cult movie podcast Proudly Resents, and you listen to my favorite movie podcast, The Projection Booth. I know, it's messed up, right?
Oh, hey there, it's Reverend Scott. You might remember me as backup singer for Kenny G and Milli Vanilli, but today I come to you as a fan of the Outside the Cinema podcast. For the last 5 years, Outside the Cinema has provided high-quality cult movie reviews every week without missing a week, and they do it all for free. But as you know, free isn't a lot of money. In order to upgrade equipment in the studio and give you the best podcast ever, we're going to need your help. Jump on the Kickstarter.com and search Outside the Cinema to become part of history. Got a movie or top six list you can't wait to hear? How about a limited edition OTC t-shirt? Want a guest host on the show or have Bill and Chris myself do a commentary track to any movie you want? Well, now you can. You can get more info at facebook.outsidethecinema.com or listen what Cinema Diabolica's very own F13 had to say.
Here's the deal. We need cash to move the gear and get a little bit more gear. If you like the show and you want to keep hearing it, then donate. If not, fuck you, I'll go on vacations. Next.
Everyone wants to spice things up in the bedroom. Here's an offer you won't want to miss. Listeners of the Projection Booth podcast can enjoy 50% off just about any one item at adamandeve.com when you use the promotion code BOOTH. You also get free shipping and 3 free adult DVDs. Once again, that promotional code is BOOTH. That's B-O-O-T-H. Visit adamandeve.com today.
I initially met David while I was working on his Dune in 1983. And I was working at Universal Studios at the time as both a part of the domestic publicity department, a theatrical division, and also as someone who was doing a lot of specialized publicity for what's now called the genre markets. In other words, science fiction conventions, horror, fantasy, Doctor Who, Star Trek, Comic Cons, which were much smaller and much less corporate back then. And in any event, I had Dune as one of a slate of projects that I was, in a sense, supervising and trying to kind of break public awareness about before the film was released. And so I was very much down on that set in Mexico City in 1983 through most of the year. And it was shot in the same, strangely enough, it was shot in the same place where Rene Cardona Sr. directed a lot of the things like Aztec Mummy versus the Wrestling Women and, you know, all of those things, all of those Santo movies. I mean, this was the exact same studio that those films were made. So that was a treat for me because I used to go into the back lot of Aztec at Churubusco, and you could see standing sets from like maybe the Brainiac or something like that. You know, they were still there. So that was a lot of fun. I was very familiar with David Lynch's work. And in fact, at the same time that I was working at Universal on the picture, I was writing a cover story for Cinefantastique magazine that would eventually turn into a double issue about the making of Dune. The reason I was assigned that was because even though I was now formally in the filmmaking industry, I had broken in as a film journalist, essentially. And I had kept up a lot of my contacts with editors and publishers, and occasionally would still do pieces when I thought it could benefit a project I was involved in. And Dune, of course, I had read the Frank Herbert novel in the 60s when it first came out because it was a book of my generation. And I was also familiar with Eraserhead, which I had seen as a midnight movie when it came out in 1977. And then later I saw a package of David's short films, like The Grandmother and The Alphabet, which was kind of put into a underground film that I saw about 1979. And then, of course, The Elephant Man had come out, and I had been really impressed by how seamlessly Lynch had transitioned within the period of one film from Eraserhead, which was, you know, kind of like the ultimate midnight movie, a very quirky, dark, obsessional story about sexual anxiety and these strange sensory impressions of another universe. He had gone from something that was so uniquely odd in a period of 3 years to something that was so polished and high theatrical and genteel like The Elephant Man. So I was really interested in meeting David. And then when I get down to Mexico City on Dune, and he's got this tremendously large project, I mean, he was exponentially getting bigger budgets and more responsibilities, and just, as Kyle MacLachlan called Dune, this lumbering beast of a movie. And I was just very impressed with how he was handling it all. So during the time that Dune was being made, I saw David becoming increasingly unhappy because he had essentially signed away the right of final cut to Dino De Laurentiis on Dune. And, of course, he was not really used to working under the commercial dictates of a big studio and a powerful producer like Dino De Laurentiis. And so, essentially, he was playing an arena that he was not happy with or suited for. So when Dune came out and was a big flop, David essentially disappeared for about almost a year. He had taken to heart the experience of Dune in such a negative way personally that I think it really bruised his artistic spirit and in a sense almost became a hurdle that he had to get over to do the next film. And he had actually told me a bit about Blue Velvet. I didn't realize it was Blue Velvet because he never said the words Blue Velvet, but he said that I asked him at one point in post-production on Dune what was going to be next. And he said he was writing a sequel to Dune, Children of Dune. He got halfway through that script and stopped it. And there was also what I realized later was Blue Velvet. He said it was a dream of strange desires wrapped in a mystery. That's how he described it. And I always remembered that. In fact, I used that line in some of my promotional material later down the line, a couple of years later when I was involved in Blue Velvet. And he said that he had heard this song, this pop song, in around 1973, which was when he started to put together what the script would ultimately be named Blue Velvet was. The Bobby Vinton song had triggered this image in his mind of a suburban neighborhood at night, a suburban street that was very quiet, and there was a single street lamp where you could see lawns. And there was a car parked at the sidewalk, and there was a driver, but it was too dark to see, other than you could tell that it was a woman with very red lips. And I really remember that image because David speaks in imagery. He's, you know, trained as a fine artist, as painter. He went to the Cochrane School of Art in Philadelphia, originally was going to be a fine artist. So he thinks in images and communicates in kind of like sensory impressions. He's an impressionist in many ways. I realized that Blue Velvet had been gestating for a long time in his mind. So to make a long, long story short, Dune comes out. It fails. David disappears. And for about a year, it transpires that he's been staying with a friend of his on the East Coast. And going back and forth between the East Coast and L.A. and avoiding the media, avoiding all kinds of Hollywood projects. But eventually, he and Dino De Laurentiis start to speak again. And they had actually enjoyed working with each other. And one or the other of them, and it's unclear which one raised the subject first, because David says it was Dino, and Dino, as I recall, told me once it was David. So I don't think either of them remembers. But apparently there had been a script written of Blue Velvet that David wasn't happy with, that had gone into turnaround to Warner Brothers. So Dino got on the phone and bought the script back from Warner Brothers and then told David, okay, let's make this, and we'll make it if we can do it like cheaply and this time and not as a big expensive picture. And David said, I will do it for scale and cut my usual fee in half and do it very cheaply if I get final cut. And as I recall, Dino said, well, look, I can't put that in a contract, because if I put that in a contract, other directors are going to say the same thing. But I'll shake hands with you on it. And it was a handshake deal, and Dino kept his word, and he gave him final cut. So Blue Velvet was done for very little money. All of the actors essentially got scale as well. And it was filmed at a studio in Wilmington, North Carolina. By 1985, by say the end of 1985, the script that David had started in 1973 called Blue Velvet was done. And they started shooting in Wilmington, North Carolina at the De Laurentiis Entertainment Group studio. Now, at this point of time, I had actually stopped working at Universal and was working for DEG, De Laurentiis Entertainment Group, in their publicity department in a more elevated position. I was very fortunate because while I was at DEG, I was able to work on things like Evil Dead 2 and Manhunter and Transformers the Movie and Near Dark and a whole slew of DEG genre films and other films as well. And Blue Velvet was one of them. I basically arranged to bring some people over to the studio to show them the new studio that Dino was building, because at that time in the mid-1980s, the studio was just really starting to come together. They only had a few sound stages. Here they all are: David Lynch, Isabella Rossellini, Dennis Hopper, Dean Stockwell, Kyle MacLachlan, Brad Dorff, Jack Nance, all of these people in this tiny town of Wilmington, which was very much a company town, because the people in Wilmington were thrilled that people were making movies in their town and that people like David Lynch were there. And one of the first things out of the gate is this bizarre, unsettling, shocking Blue Velvet.
Tell me about your duties as kind of what you did while you were on the set. And, you know, I'm not familiar with what your position would be doing at this time.
What my responsibility was as a marketing specialist and a publicist was to not only at the time, just before a film was being released, to get the word out, but also maybe a year or so beforehand, try to build interest in these movies while they were in production. So that meant I would have to become familiarized as at least the way that I operated, the way my preferred mode of operation was to learn as much about the film as I could. So I would be able to answer any questions or hit separate markets, for instance, like the specialized science fiction markets, or for instance, like the higher end academic film markets, like say the Film Comment crowd or the Sight and Sound crowd, or like maybe the LA Times where you just had the media journalist. I mean, I was dealing virtually with all the spectrum of media critics. And so I was supplying material to them in all different kinds of formats. So that meant often that I would go to a set and I would hang out for a while, get a feel of what the project was like, look at clips, keep tabs on the production as it was going on. And then in my other capacity as a entertainment writer and as a serious film journalist, I would quite often follow a production from stem to stern and write about it as it was being made, not for publicity or marketing purposes, but for historical ones. So I was really doing kind of two jobs at once. It essentially meant I was totally immersed in these films I was involved in. So with Blue Velvet, I was so intrigued that I went to some people at DEG who were above me and said, can I get a permission to go out to Wilmington and spend a few days out there when they first start, because they were just going to start filming, and just get a feel for it, because I'd read part of the script. I didn't have the whole script at that part at that time, because David was very secretive about his projects, and he didn't like to get things out ahead of time, which made my job very difficult. I had read part of it and had been very intrigued by it, and then I got out to Wilmington just in time for Dennis Hopper to show up. And Dennis Hopper's first scene with Isabella Rossellini, I mean, their first day they worked together, and they didn't know each other. I think they'd had like a lunch or a dinner or a breakfast or something like that. But their very first scene was that rape that Kyle MacLachlan witnesses. So that was, of course, a closed set, which meant that only essential film personnel were allowed. But you could stand outside the set, which many people were doing. I'd kind of get, you could hear the dialogue that was going on and get an idea of what was being filmed. And of course, I knew what the scene was about. And so I remember just listening to this out in the hallway, essentially, and thinking, oh my God, you know, this thing is like, what are they doing in there? And then I saw the footage and I realized that it was visually non-graphic, but the power was in the performances and the perversion of what was going on, that this was like this intense sadomasochistic relationship where Isabella Rossellini's character, Dorothy Valens, was basically locked into this abusive, tyrannical kidnap scenario by this guy who was really in love with her. Because I always thought Frank Booth was in love with Isabella's character, but just he didn't understand love, to put it mildly. His love came through violence, and he was totally smitten. So I remember just like being bowled over by that and then thinking on the plane ride back, wow, how lucky is that? I mean, that's got to be one of the highlights of the picture. And I also had drinks with David and hung out with some of the other guys, because I had met Jack Nance and Brad Dourif previously on Dune. They were both on that picture. And Jack Nance liked to drink. And when he would drink, he would start to recite poetry. And I remember him doing The Wasteland by T.S. Eliot to a bar full of very confused North Carolina rednecks. But in any event, I came back and I started to track this film. And so when it was finally put together, Dino had his own screening room at the DEG offices in Beverly Hills on Wilshire Boulevard. And Dino ran a screening just for me of the film. And I think it was the second time it had been screened in-house. And the first time was when it was screened for Dino. And that was just a day or two before I saw it. And I'm sitting there by myself, and that Angelo Badalamenti soundtrack music comes up, and you just see those blue velvet curtains swaying in the breeze. And immediately I was in that other world. And I came out of that film just so up. I know that sounds a strange reaction to something that is so unsettling, but that film was so unique and so obviously a product of love and such a singular vision of the hell and the heaven of human existence. To me, I thought, oh wow, this is really going to make an impact. So I said, whatever you guys do with this picture, I want to be involved. I want to make it one of my priorities to get it out to these varying levels of media outlets that I dealt with. Well, Blue Velvet then has a sneak preview out in the San Fernando Valley and it was snuck to an audience, a test audience, after a screening of Top Gun. Now, this is true. You cannot have a worse crowd for Blue Velvet than the crowd that just watched, you know, Maverick and Goose, you know, shooting planes out of the sky, right? And so here comes Blue Velvet, and the cards came back, and they were overwhelmingly negative. People were saying, this is the worst, you know, this director should be hung. How dare you brutalize this woman? People just did not get this picture. And I think the reason why they didn't get it is because it's so strange and confusing, at least superficially, because it all makes sense when if you go back to it. There's an internal cohesion and logic in Blue Velvet that's very consistent. It really works in its own world. But this was not the crowd to show Blue Velvet to. And so the studio freaked and panicked. And they said, Dino said basically, well, you know, I don't know what to do with this movie. And the confusion and the fear filtered down very quickly. And the studio was just going to dump it. They were going to have a few screenings here and there, a few prints. And as someone who had followed it for a while at this point, and very much in the background, by the way, David remembered me from Dune, and David and I, you know, would exchange pleasantries and, you know, this and that. But I was kind of behind the scenes of the behind the scenes and just waiting for the moment. And this moment came and presented itself. And I said, look, guys, I have to go to Chicago to do a trade show. And why don't I bring a print of Blue Velvet and show it to Siskel and Ebert? Now, they had their own screening room, as I recall, and it was a small one. And I bring the film there. We arrange something for them. They come in by themselves. There was an old rumor that went around that they didn't really like each other, and they didn't. They hardly said a word to each other. They sat at opposite ends of the theater. Dead silence. Occasionally, they would make notes into pads, as I recall. I'm up in the projectionist booth with the projectionist, looking down and watching their reaction. And they are both riveted throughout. They never take their eyes off the screen. I think I saw maybe Ebert may have made one or two notes. And Siskel, I remember, I hardly wrote anything at all. And the lights come up, and I remember the exact opposite of what I thought was going to happen occurred, and that was this. Roger Ebert, of course, had written the screenplay for Beyond the Valley of the Dolls and worked for Russ Meyer and was a big champion of quirky independent films and 70s cinema, and I thought he would get this movie and really like it. And Ebert was sitting there in front, and you could see the confusion on his face. It was like, what did I just see? And he... during the screening itself, I remember when Frank Booth says, when they go to the bar and Comic Walkland asks for a Heineken, and Frank Booth says, Heineken, fuck that, Pabst Blue Ribbon, which is a famous, hilarious line. Ebert laughed very loudly. I remembered, not, oh, good, he's with it. But then I could see, more than anything else on his face, confusion. And he went out, and I asked him, I said, what did you think? And Siskel said, you know, I don't know what to think. I said, but I think I really like it. I mean, I don't think I've seen anything like this. And he basically had a WTF expression on his. But Ebert, you could tell, he seemed lost. It was like a very strange reaction. Now, they then went on to their show, and Ebert very famously savaged the movie and said, he didn't realize why David Lynch had to treat Isabella Rossellini like that, and that was an actress being abused and not had nothing the story that he wanted to see, and so forth and so on. None of that anger manifested itself in the screening at all. So I think what happened was Ebert went back and sorted his feelings out and literally was so overcome and confused by the power of the film, he didn't get it. I think that he realized that Lynch in his own way was being highly moralistic in Blue Velvet. I mean, Blue Velvet says that the real world is horrible. It's both horrible and foolish, silly and appalling at the same time. Plus, it was presented in such a completely self-enclosed and uniquely weird way that rather clear-cut moral, I think, got obscured by the uncanniness of its presentation. So I honestly think Ebert didn't get the movie, that it was a serious movie. It was seriously weird, but it was actually about something. It wasn't an exploitation movie or some empty high art concept thing. I mean, David's very sincere If nothing else, he's a sincere filmmaker. So I think it got inside of him enough. Another thing to take into consideration is during this period of the 1980s, the whole slasher film cycle had really caught fire, starting with Halloween in the late 70s and Friday the 13th. And all of those films were like proliferating like lethal viruses. And they were like all these weird spinoffs were happening. And Siskel and Ebert really took great delight in puncturing every slasher film that came out. In fact, they became very moralistic and high-handed about it and started to condemn this whole slasher genre's representation of violence towards women. And I think Ebert's reaction against Blue Velvet to a great extent was fueled by his confusing it with a slasher film. I think he saw Blue Velvet as just another higher-toned version of a drive-in slasher movie. So I think that's one of the problems that he had with it. Did you ever see the cut scenes that they put on the DVD?
Yeah, some great stuff.
Yeah. Did you know that the scene where Frank and his crew and Kyle and Isabella come in and they grab the guy and throw him on the pool table and with a half-naked woman next to him? That's the guy who lost the ear. Why Frank's mad at him. Think either in an original draft, because David wrote at least four or five drafts of this. It was either an original draft or it was discussed while they were shooting. But I distinctly remember that the reason behind that anger was that that guy had lost the ear, that Frank had cut the ear off of the kidnapped husband, and somehow this guy had gotten a hold of it and had a hole in his pocket, and it had fallen out of his pocket in the field. That's what that was all about. That's why he was so angry. And so because he had lost it, he had lost his ear, you know, which was going to be what he was going to use, you know, to hold over Isabella Rossellini. You know, here's part of your husband. You know, you better do what I want. And also the part where the nipples, the woman sets her nipples on fire, that's an old stripper trick. Apparently, we were told that strippers do that in clubs where they get paper matches and they split them and they just clamp them around the nipple. And so that the head of the match is out, maybe, you know, like half an inch away from the nipple itself. And it looks like you're setting nipples on fire from a distance, but you're not. So it was really, really just a cheap little trick type of thing. And God knows where David picked that up. You know, probably one of the girls there, you know, who was on the set that day was, you know, a professional, quote unquote. But that's something that's real that they actually used to do in strip clubs. I don't know if they still do that or not. And also there are two things that are not in, that were shot, that are not in that lost footage section. One is, and there's a line of dialogue that contradicts this, but if you saw the original cut, which I did, by the way, if you'll notice, there's a scene in the lost footage, as they now call it, where Kyle is at a fraternity dance and sees a couple in a furnace room starting to make out, and the guy starts to go too far, and he's spying on them. And the guy is almost starting to rape this girl, and Kyle says, "Cut it out," and the guy stops. There was actually a scene before that where Kyle is a football player, and that's why he's in that fraternity. It's a jock fraternity. And I don't know why they cut that, because there's also a part where Carl lies later in the film. They say, "Do you play football?" And he goes, "No." And I always wondered why. It was like David kind of trying to say, well, here's something, you know, this guy is now in this other town. He's left his college. He has a girlfriend in college. That whole subplot was cut out too. And he's got a new girlfriend. He's back at home, and he's kind of making things up. He's kind of like reinventing himself. And I always thought, well, maybe that's what was going on. But I still have stills of him. I have a lot of stills of this footage that was cut that I've had for almost 30 years now. And it was amusing for me to finally see it on a DVD because I'd seen a lot of this stuff before.
We're sorry, but we've run out of time. Be sure to listen to the rest of this episode at jackaloperadio.com in the Projection Booth archives. And be sure to leave your feedback at projection-booth.com. Stay classy.